Accession number 28759, Real 8.
Same map. The scout car. They had a look at it, and they reckoned they could, not wrong with it. And they looked around it and see if there were any booby traps on it. There weren't. There was a mine. They think it had been primed, but it wasn't. And they were able to take that back with them. And then I found the most extraordinary thing inside this church or chapel place. It was a store. And we went into this store, and it was full in neat racks of HMV gramophone records, of operas and all kinds of things. The tragic thing was I had it in another room there, and I thought, well, there's something there, and I found a body in bed, actually. It was an elderly person who'd obviously died, and they hadn't been able to move around. So we got down, but we got that sorted out. But it was amazing sometimes to find some of these places there. We were able to use the tower there. It's a very good OP. Then we moved on a bit further. And we then got... I suddenly got a poster, a message from our regimental headquarters to report back to Naples, where we were miles up past Rimini then. Go back to Naples. You've got to go and have a Air Force medical. Oh, I didn't know what that was about. I thought it was cross lines. So made him through the aid, and he said, no, it's come through from the army. He said, you've got to have this medical, and if you pass the medical, you'll be sent back to the UK. So I left the regiment rather sadly. And that's how I came back to England.
So you passed your medical you had the medical in Naples?
In Naples, yeah.
And then got onto a ship? You weren't flown back, you came back by ship?
Ship, mm-hmm. The Scarcia. Met my brother, who was in the Lovett Scouts, in Italy with the Poles. He was a medical officer. He was supposed to be he was in the mountains, because I went down to see him. And on the map, it looked as though it wasn't far from where I was, you see. There was a mountain between me and him. They were just short of Florence, on the hills with the Poles.
Was it like meeting your brother in the middle of Italy? I mean, when had you last seen him?
Quite a long time before. But I didn't recognise him at first because the Lovett Scouts were completely different to us. I mean, he was, because they were a mountain division, they were sort of ski outfits. Because they were all skiers. He trained them in Scotland, Balmoral. They all come from Invergordon. I met quite a lot of them on this cruise I went on. And I've got a picture of him and the Lovett Scouts and the Queen and George the Sixth and the Princess Margaret and Princess Elizabeth then at Balmoral, all in a group photograph. There's a lot of Norwegians in it.
And what were their function was to what, fight harass the Germans?
They were the reconnaissance troops for a mountain division which we were organising before the end of the war, that was, because they went out to Canada to do ski training at Banff or somewhere. And all these fellas were from the Western Isles.
Well known for its mountains.
What they were good at, these fellas, they could walk, 40 miles, they thought nothing of. They, enjoyed it. They finished up in Italy, actually in the mountains, which is the rest of the mountain division, was sent to Holland.
Anyway, so you meet up with
him. I digress.
Yes, that's what this is all about. I mean, what was it like? What did he tell you of his experiences? Had it been?
Well, it was a good experience for them, because it was a question of mules and getting wounded back from one mountain top to another. He had quite a tough time. He's still going strong. He's 88 now, 89.
Where is he?
He lives at near Kroma.
I wonder if he might be a good person to interview as well, I should think.
Well, he would, yes.
But anyway,
he finished up in Greece. Remember the trouble they had in Greece?
I do.
Aoka people.
Well, that's much later.
Yes, after the war was over
Cyprus.
A bit, they were sent to Greece to sort out the Aoka people.
I know that the archive is particularly looking. We'll talk about that when I switch this off. Anyway, back to you. And you're now, so the Gothic line, we've done the Gothic line. You're going back to...
Yes, the whole point of those, they were a series really of leapfrogging from one, and then you had to have a big pitch battle and move on to the next thing. The Germans were retreating because they were getting appalling casualties in Russia. And they were really... I don't know how they carried on. When I got to Germany later on and found these factories making jet planes underground and all these people, and the bombing, I mean... I'd seen bombing in England, with bombing and so on and so forth. But when you're standing in Cologne, when I got there, and you could stand on a chair and you could see across Cologne, except for the towers on the cathedral. We bombed and bombed, I don't know.
Let's go back to you back now in the UK. You've come back. Where are we now?
Well, I landed at Liverpool. And my wife knew where I was because she was working for the Element shipping line in Cobham. She was in charge of bunkering for the ships, and she knew where the ship was. And we were engaged to be married before that. Yeah, that's right. And I rang her up from at home in her home in Cobham, and words to me, well, thank God you've arrived. This is a Saturday, because you're getting married next Saturday or something. I don't know where the hell I was.
Oh, nice.
So that was that. We were married. We had rather a good time now, because apart from medical, I was sent to Number 22 EFTS, Elementary Flying Training School, at Cambridge, Newmarket Road, Cambridge, to learn how to fly. Because you were going to teach me how to fly a plane, so I could join the AeroP. And we were married, and we lived in Diggs in Cambridge.
And this is now the winter of... this is coming up to Christmas of
45. We made it in January 45.
So this is early January 45, right? Mm. The war is coming slowly
to the end, yes. Because when I was doing the flying there, the European war finished. But the jet war, and we were all geared up and training to fly in the jungle.
Let's go, I mean, briefly to go through the way that you were trained and the kind of aircraft that you were trained on. Can you take me through that?
Yeah, well, the EFTS, I was based at Cambridge, and you trained on the DH-85, which was a Tiger Moth, which was a tandem type of training plane. The pupil sat back, the instructor in front. I had various instructors, mostly chaps who'd been to the... They all had to go to the flying school, but they'd all done time in bomber command or something. My first one was a chap called Clements. And he used to take off from Cambridge, and we go up. You had to go up when you were training to about 4,000, 5,000 feet to do aerobatics, you know, clear of all the bomber thing. And then he'd start doing loops and rolls and things. And I, first of all, when I was doing that, I didn't feel very well somehow. And he used to turn up and look to, you know, not in the best of health, and he'd go out and do these spins and things, and then he'd say, well, this is a bit later on, I must admit. It's what you say when you've got a pupil and instructor. It's a you taker. That means you take over. And you have to say, I've got her. And he said, and he very often used to say, well, I feel fine now. You take her. And I'd be, well, first time I was doing this thing, I think I spewed out of the back. My first interruption. What was rather interesting about that place, it was a maintenance unit where they used to bring planes that had been repaired, mostly on undercarriages and things like that. And they were quite a variety, Albemarles, and later on we used to have mosquitoes and things. And they'd land on this field, it was. Before they had the concrete runway there, because I went back to Cambridge and marshalled my work there. And it was all grass field, and it all land on these things. And then they'd take a truck out there and put a ladder up for the pilot, and that would get a young girl. We were trying to land these tigers for the first time, and you get off, you go, blah, blah, blah. These girls were flying them to the from Marshalls or to the works to the squadrons, you see. So that used to cheer us up. And we did all the training there. We did blind flying link training. And you did a pilot navigator course, night flying and stuff like that. But it was dead easy, really, in that part of the world because it's fairly flattish country. And Ely Cathedral sticks out like a sore thumb because I don't think it's painted white, but the roof of Ely Cathedral looked white from wherever you are. So, because you only start off with, and you're flying and you're turning, and you get a bit lost, but you can soon pick up your bearings when you can feel that the Ely Cathedral, provided it's fairly clear air. And we have had a mob of us there.
Were they other artillery people?
Artillery and people who were learning to fly gliders. They wanted them to.
So you went through this you trained
in the course,
and that took how long?
From in January through to June, July.
What are your memories of VE Day then?
VE Day, well, VE Day. We had a party in the mess there. And we had a lot of it was quite serious training, actually, because the Far East was very much on. And we were learning to wish to fly on golf, land on golf courses mostly. All smaller and smaller. We used to go down to near Bournemouth and down to a golf course there, or just off the coast, or the edge of the coast and cliffs, because it was a nice place to go and land on. And then we used to go and do much more training in fields, small fields. And there are about 48 different lessons when you're flying, and lesson one is familiarization with the cockpit is the first one. That's the joystick, that's the bit, that. Through to, I think 24 was landing over obstacles, which is landing in a very confined space. There'll very often be cables and wires and things. You should do that. So you've got a very thorough, very good training.
And this again was always in the Tiger Moth. You didn't.
No, Tiger Moth, and then we started with Austers. Auster ones. And then the one we used in Germany and for flying was the fours and fives. See, while I was at Anzio, I became what they call both Henry Fane and I, two officers out of one of the regiments there, which was the 24th, and we joined up with the Americans. We had an American pilot, and their system was different to ours. They had an American or a pilot sitting in front and on a Piper cub, and in the back was a chap called a liaison officer, which was an artillery officer, who just used to direct the fire. So we did a lot of that in Italy.
You didn't tell me that.
Yes, I've got to tell you that.
Quite important, really. Tell me about that. What was it like flying over Anzio then?
Well, flying over Anzio was one of the... I've forgotten all that. I think sometimes I get that, because sometimes I go into a room and forget why I've come into it. One of the problems in Anzio was there was so much of our own firing. We had all sorts. We used to use anti-aircraft 3.7s to help the field guns, because we had quite a lot of anti-aircraft guns there.
These would be used as artillery?
Yes, just for firing, land firing. They were not very useful because they were fused ammunition, you know, it's used to burst. They introduced fuses, but for only burst on contact. But they weren't very good as field guns because they had a high muzzle velocity. It was much easier with the 25-pounders and the 105s and the 5-inch and the 9.2s and things like that. The main thing is we used to have to plan where we would be able to fly without getting hit by our own shells. We diligently drew up graphs about the height of the shells and certain distances. And eventually it got so complicated we thought, we've got to take potluck somewhere because it's very difficult to find a space where you can be certain that you won't get hit. When you fired your own guns and you were sort of slightly behind them, and then what you used to do, of course, was to fly near the ground, and then you'd be in contact with the guns, who gave you, after you've given the orders, you always say, give them an order, say, 5 rounds gunfire, which meant from the battery, but you had to have the time of flight, that's the time from the gun to the target, because you could then know where you'd possibly see a burst. What you're looking for was the burst, contact with the ground. And it's very important to know that. And so you used to, they'd say, shot one, 55. And so then on your watch, you 55 seconds. So that's important to keep that accurately. And then you'd come up. You knew them more or less the direction because you'd given them the map references to do it, and look for the burst on the ground. So you flew very low and circulating behind your guns, and then many gave you the shot one, 55 or 15 or whatever the figure was at the time. You then came up to the height as late as possible.
To watch for the explosions.
You could see it.
How were you communicating with the guns?
By radio. The American radio was quite good. It was fixed. They had fixed cartridges for the... you couldn't vary the wavelength on them. And that was quite good because they were pretty clear.
This was direct talk. I mean, you were talking. You weren't, oh, you weren't,
yes,
Morse.
Yeah. I had a throat mic.
And you obviously felt fine about this. This is why they selected you to become a pilot later on.
Yes. That's why I put in for it.
I see. You actually put in for this. I see.
Well, you ought to use to go. See, there were courses. Every time, there were two things in the army. I said, there still are. Part one orders, part two orders. Part one orders are daily orders. Like, you know, regiment is here, we'll stay here today, or something like that. Part two orders were rather important because it affected everything else. Your pay, your position, your rank, this and so on and so forth. And part two orders also for communications from above your squadron or above your regiment. And there were always on there that people are required for commandos or for skiing or for something special, staff college or gunnery. And so in order to, the only way you could possibly get leave or go home or something like that, you used to put your name down. It's like a lottery. And when I did the flying, suddenly wanted some more, they wanted more pilots. And so I put my name down, not thinking I'd ever get a reply. But it came up about a year later.
Was it effective in ANZIO using AROP?
Yes, very, very. Because it was very difficult to get OPs sometimes. It's rather flattish. And as I mentioned before, it's a marvellous thing for observing the enemy to find their, where their guns were.
Because you could, what would you see?
Well, you can see the flash when they fired, or in the smoke, or any movement, or dust, or anything like that. And the Germans didn't like it, you see. As soon as they saw an Auster flying, coming up off the deck, they used to stop firing, because they didn't want to give away their position sometimes.
This wasn't an Auster, was it? This was a Piper Cub, you said.
Oh, that was the Americans' Piper, very like an Auster, a high-wing monoplane.
Did they fly Austers at ANZIO as well?
Yes, we had an AROP squadron.
You did? I see, I didn't know it existed already.
Yeah.
And I suppose the advantage that you, with your artillery experience, would be able to work with the guns much better than...
Oh, yes. Yes.
So that's why they decided to train...
Well, then the rest of the Americans had pilots. They trained the pilots and they got their artillery people to come and sit in the planes. Whereas we, you know, as being British, we were slightly different. We thought it was easier... As a pilot, it was easier. It was very difficult sometimes to point out to some of the pilots you had. You know, they were all very amazing and quite good at their job eventually, but you had to more or less train them because you wanted them to fly in a certain place. It wasn't very easy. My daughter.
Okay, shall I pause it? Hello, hi. Right. So... Anything else about that ANZIO, the AROP there that strike? I mean, were you...
Well, it was very, very effective. That's what impressed me, I think. It was much easier, and I could see it was much easier to be a pilot and do that than actually be just a liaison thing. It worked. Quite well. Our difficulty at ANZIO was, of course, we were so squashed up. And the landing fields, you can imagine, we had two. And it was, you know, it was shelled now and again. In fact, the chap that I started off with, he got killed. Then he didn't get killed by the enemy, he killed himself in the airplane. They used to... And I would like doing aerobatics close to the ground. These chaps, they got a bit bomb happy, I think.
And what, he turned his over and flew into the ground?
He killed himself half a minute at a time. He's on his own.
When you came to do the training back in Britain in 1945, you were trained as a pilot and a navigator, but also you were also trained to work with guns as well as a pilot. Was there extra?
Yeah, I was then when you've done qualified it, when you've flown solo, you're given 8 hours training. And if you needed more than 8 hours, you had to fly with the chief flying instructor, and he would probably say, oh, you've got to have another hour. But if you didn't do it the next hour, you got RTU. And then the unit.
Return to unit, then.
And but you got a good training. I mean, they didn't go and let you, you know, made it safe. They made it safe. And you didn't get any, I never saw any casualties. There were my old pal from the 24th Field Regiment prior to, because he went first. I was the second one to go from. He got killed at the Lark Hill.
In a tiger moth?
No, in an Oster. Got hit by a 5.5-inch shell on the ranges, which it shouldn't have happened, because you're supposed to have safety officers. But he got injured and he died later. It was very hard luck.
So can you tell me about the training then, once you qualified as a pilot?
Well, the pilot was very much getting you to fly, and we did, after you soloed, you did a lot of training on your own, flying different places in England on your own, different airports and so on and so forth. And then you then went to Andover, which is still a grass field, right alongside the 303 road. And you then, because it's close to Lark Hill, and you do your gunnery training from there. I used to fly from there down to the Lark Hill and land at Lark Hill, and you'd have a troop being trained on the ranges, and you'd join in the observation of fire on Lark Hill. And it was a pretty thorough training. You had more or less what they call instructor of gunnery course there, because you had to do it all by the book.
But you had an instructor with you in the Oster as well when you were up there, of course.
No, because you were now flying solo, so you did everything on your own.
Well, how did you find it as an aircraft to fly?
Well, it's dead easy to fly because. Stalled it and stalled turns, and you throw the thing about a bit, as well. Like they used to, there was Boscombe Down, was right alongside the 303, which is the jet training, where they train all the top pilots on jets. And they used to have a game with us, you see, and he used to be flying from Andover in an Oster. And I used to follow the road, and these chaps used to take off. They were using twin boom. They were just starting twin boom DH-110s and the VIC-5s, and. Unbeknown to them, unless you kept a good body, you kept a good lookout, because you could have an observer if you wanted in an Oster sitting slightly backwards, looking out. And unbeknown to you, or unless you kept a good lookout, but I used to make sure and watch, you can see when they were taken off. And they'd go either above you a long way in the south, you couldn't see, and then you'd be tooling along slowly, thinking about other things, and this thing would be right behind you suddenly, and then doing about 300 or 400, and then you get put down, and they go hop over you, and of course, the arse end of the thing is to shake the air out of the ripple. So they used to go up and down. however.
Swearing at them over your RT, yes.
Yes.
Okay, Graham Rowntree, Reel 9. This is probably...